From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, caring for the soul of corporate America, we'll talk with poet David White. He takes poetry into corporations in an effort to humanize the workplace. White says his work is not about teaching executives how to write poetry, but about rediscovering a depth of feeling and creativity that gets lost when we're at our jobs. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the Montreal Tapes, a live concert recording featuring bassist Charlie Hayden, trumpeter Don Cherry, and drummer Edward Blackwell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Defense Secretary William Perry says the United States is ready to house 10,000 Cubans at Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba indefinitely. The new Clinton administration policy is intended to prevent a tidal wave of refugees from reaching U.S. shores. But the new policy isn't deterring them. Up to 1,000 refugees are being plucked from the sea every day. These are the highest numbers since the 1980 Mariel boat lift. The White House is playing down talk of a naval blockade of Cuba. Spokeswoman Dede Meyers says the administration won't rule it out, but she says it is not a first option. Brisk winds are clearing smoky skies in several western states today, but they also fanned several of the 32 major fires still burning in seven states. Jill Hoyt of member station KBSU reports from Boise.
A blaze north of Boise grew from 2,000 to 20,000 acres over the weekend because of high winds. One house burned, two dozen others are still threatened. Residents are not allowed to return home. In northwestern Montana, three dozen homes are in danger near the town of Libby. Most of the Kootenai National Forest is closed. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has agreed to help fight the Montana blazes by providing money, but not much-needed personnel. A fire along the California-Nevada border is 50% contained. The blaze moved from thick forest to sagebrush, making it easier for workers to dig fire lines. Cooler weather is also helping. For the first time in 40 days, temperatures dropped to below 90 degrees here in Boise. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyt.
Egyptian authorities have executed five Islamic extremists. They were sentenced to death for trying to kill a senior government minister. Police in southern Egypt have also shot three suspected extremists to death as the executions were being carried out. Alf Hermida reports from Cairo.
The executions come a year after the attack against the interior minister Hassan al-Alfi. Egypt's top security official narrowly escaped death last August when a powerful bomb exploded in central Cairo as his motorcade drove by. Two of the attackers and three civilians were killed in the explosion. Five Islamic militants were sentenced to death last month for their role in the bombing. They were hanged at dawn, bringing to more than 40 the number of militants executed in the past 2 years. The executions reflect the government's determination to crush the militants trying to overthrow the state. The tough policy appears to have paid off, with a significant drop in militant activity in recent months. But there are still sporadic shootouts, as the one today in Upper Egypt, in which police shot dead three suspected militants. For National Public Radio, this is Alfred Hamida in Cairo.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down almost 4 points at 3,751. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is down half a point at 741. This is NPR. Illinois Congressman Mel Reynolds has appeared in a Chicago courtroom to face sexual assault charges. He didn't enter a plea today, but he's denied the charges previously. Reynolds faces allegations of obstruction of justice, child pornography, sexual assault, and statutory rape. He's also charged with trying to block witnesses from testifying truthfully. These charges stem from a former campaign worker's claim that she had a relationship with him when she was a minor. Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping is 90 years old today. There's little official acknowledgement of his birthday, but China's leading newspaper has printed a photo of him that's a decade old. The BBC's Carrie Gracie reports from Beijing.
The Deng Xiaoping who smiles out from the front page of today's People's Daily is 10 years younger than the pale, shrunken figure who was shown on state television in February, struggling to stand and unable to make his slurred speech intelligible to his audience. But the stark contrast between the man of the 10-year-old photograph and the man of today will only serve to remind the Chinese public that for all the upbeat official statements about his diet, exercise and activities, China's elder statesman is increasingly fragile. In a half-page editorial, the People's Daily paid tribute to Mr. Deng's theory of socialism with Chinese characteristics, essentially market economics in the one-party state. It said his policies should endure for 100 years.
Carrie Gracie reporting. The ruling Mexican Party's candidate for president is claiming victory in yesterday's elections in Mexico. Opponents say the voting was unfair. Ernesto Zedillo is claiming the win, even though only about 22% of the ballots have been counted. Both Mexican and foreign observers say there were fraud and voting irregularities, especially in rural areas. Ballot shortages prevented thousands from voting. The election's been seen as an important test of Mexican stability. The country's faced a strong Indian uprising and the death of a popular presidential candidate this year. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Do you ever feel frustrated by your job? Your boss wants you to be more creative and productive, but anything that might foster your individuality and passions threatens your superiors. So you find a medium for yourself that may or may not be happy, and before you know it, years have gone by. Or as Dante wrote, "In the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood where the true way was wholly lost." My guest, David White, uses poetry, his own and that of others, to help people find what they think they've lost on the road to becoming adults in the workforce. His new book is The Heart Aroused, Poetry and the Preservation of the Soul in Corporate America. For the past 7 years, White has been reciting Beowulf and the poems of Rilke, Yeats, Pablo Neruda, and Mary Oliver for CEOs, managers, and workers at companies across the country. He says that corporations must be a place where people can ask questions about their own destiny. White has also published 3 collections of his own poetry and has worked as a naturalist and guide in the Galapagos, Nepal, Britain, and Ireland. One of his favorite poems for breaking the ice in the corporate setting is David Wagner's poem, Lost. It's adapted from a Native American teaching story.
This is the kind of story that will be told to a young boy or girl who asks the question, what do I do when I'm lost in the forest? Which was a really pragmatic question in the Northwest. If you were wandering into a 150-foot tall cedar forest, you lost sight of all 4 cardinal directions almost immediately. But it could equally be asked by someone, a street kid in Philadelphia or a middle manager in a large organization, what do I do when I'm lost, when the surroundings do not tell me who I really am? And here's the answer that the elder gives to the young child. What do I do when I'm lost in the forest? Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. Listen, the forest breathes. It whispers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again saying here. If you leave it, you may come back again saying here. No 2 trees are the same to raven. No 2 branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. Stand still. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you.
How do you think poetry serves as a guide through those difficult times, those moments of feeling lost or feeling some kind of existential loneliness?
Well, poetry, you know, is the human heart speaking into the world. And it's very precise. You know, in some ways, we've lost a whole body of wisdom about how precise the inner world is. We think it's all wet and woolly in there. You should only go in holding the hand of a trained psychologist. But for thousands of years, men and women like you and I have sat down and written about the most difficult transitions of being alive, and many of them happen to have been great poets.
Well, you certainly write your own poetry, and you have memorized the poems of many other poets. Does it feel then that poems live in your bones, if you know what I mean?
It does, because you, in order to memorize it, you have to learn the rhythm of it. And the rhythm of a poem has everything to do with the physical experience that the poet had in the first place. And the rhythm holds the kind of physical body that the person, you know, every experience we have a kind of physical parallel to it. It's not just a conceptual thing. It's like Proust when he broke those little cookies, you know, and smelled a whole life coming alive again in his coffee cup. And we have all kinds of physical components to all of our memories, all of our desires, our longings for ourselves, and it's the rhythm itself which holds that physicality. So when you learn a poem, you have to learn the rhythm, otherwise the poem doesn't come out right. And the first time you learn it, it may be a while before you actually get to the depths of it. And we use this phrase, to have it by heart, and it's a very accurate description, actually, that you would get it in your heart, and you would be able to speak it from your heart, as if you've heard it from the first time.
Let me ask you about growing up, and we can tell from your accent you're not from Seattle, but did you grow up with poets and storytellers? Do you feel like you came from a family that reveled in language and words?
Well, they reveled in language, but not in this in the literate sense. But I grew up in the north of England, in Yorkshire, next to the moors. My father was Yorkshire, born and bred, but my mother's Irish, came across when she was a young woman to the north of England. And here were these two traditions colliding in our small house. In Yorkshire, where a spade is a spade, and always will be a spade, and you use it for certain things. In Ireland, where a spade can be anything you want it to be, depending on the story you're telling. And in Yorkshire, the storytelling tradition has to do with small vignettes that you would tell again and again, exactly the same. And everyone laughs exactly the same, and in just the right places every time, no matter how many times you've heard it. But in Ireland, the story would never be the same. I heard stories from my mother, they would be different every time. And you would never let a few facts get in the way of the true spirit of the story in Ireland. And I think, you know, as a child, I intuited that part of our tragedy is that we're constantly choosing between these two worlds, between the pragmatic and the imaginative, and that actually our lives come alive where we bring them both together. And that has always been the task of the poet, to speak your internal images, those images which are so precious to you that they have everything to do with you, out into the world. And that you would make a huge difference in yourself, but also the world around you, if you could do that. And that's the hope of the poet.
Do you think you have successfully incorporated these two strands of your family?
I would say it's an ongoing discipline, ongoing struggle to bring them both together. You know, we're constantly choosing between the life of the imagination and our car payments. And really, life will not let us choose.
Well, let me... Yeah.
There's some marvelous lines by Rilke where he says... I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord. I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord because death's note wants to climb over, and in the dark interval, reconciled, they stay there trembling, and the song goes on, beautiful. So you see Rilke there, he's saying, we're always wanting to be the notes. By the way, that's a marvelous translation by Robert Bly of a poem by Rilke. And he's saying we're always wanting to be the notes, to the point at which all the silence disappears in our life and the place where the notes come from and the rhythm of the music. And what you end up with is a kind of 60-cycle hum, which, like an old rusty refrigerator, you would only notice when it actually switched itself off. And that the true life has to do with having the notes and then this tremendous silence between them. So how do you cultivate silence in your life? And in fact, that's the second part of that lost poem. The second quality, the first quality is you must pay tremendous attention. Second quality is the only way this attention can flower is to have some real abilities for silence in your life. That may mean, you know, the ability to be really quiet, or it may just mean that you have an ability not to have easy answers for everything.
That
you would let life take its own forms and allow it lots of room to do that.
I notice even in just the couple of lines of poetry that you've said so far that you repeat a lot of lines and as if to kind of go back and I don't know whether you're caressing them again or you're using that to make a special point.
I do, and if we had more time in this radio interview, I'd probably be repeating them even more. But
you're behaving yourself.
I am, yes. And but, you know, often one of the disturbing aspects of a poetry reading, often in cafes and things, is that the poetry is so strong, and it's only read once, and it's literally like a train going past. So all you get is the Doppler effect, this wham of this line going past, and you say, my God, what was that? And before it has had time to actually rest into your physical body, the poet is on to the next line. And so many of us have actually been put off poetry readings because it can actually be disturbing to your psyche and your body to sit there and listen to these incredibly profound truths and have no place to hold them.
It's almost like too much input.
It is. And this repetition is as old as the hills. You know, it's there in the Greek chorus. It's in our pop songs today. That you would take a line and you would hold it and you would say it three or four different ways until finally it's there and you say, now, you know, we can move on. And isn't that the way we converse? You know, we ask each other questions. We say, did he really say that? And even there in the rhythm is a line of poetry. You know? And you say, yes, he did. And you say, he did. And then you pass on, you know. And this is very natural to human conversation when it's at the edge of discovery. And so so it's nothing new. It's as old as the hills. We've just forgotten how to do it. But I think it's really important.
Let me ask you about also the work that you did in the Galapagos Islands. I know you studied zoology, and you went to Galapagos for a couple of years.
Yes.
What did you do there, and how do you think that helped develop you as a poet?
Well, in some ways, you know, I chose to do sciences because you had to specialize early in England at 16. And to the great grief of my English master, I chose to do biology, chemistry, and physics and went off to study marine zoology at university. And by sheer fate and good luck, I ended up as a naturalist guide in the Galapagos Islands. And really, it was I've written poetry since I was small, but it was my, in some ways, it was my re-entry, my re-initiation into poetry as a grown adult. Because it taught me how to pay attention to the world and that there is no real speech without the kind of care and attention for the world about which the speech, you know, the speech is all about our relationship and our world. If it's just about me, then it's only confessional and it's only my drama, and I will always be lost in that drama. There will be no sacred otherness that can take me out of my self-pity. But Galapagos was always there to draw you into its miraculousness. You would be walking along the trail, and there would be a Galapagos hawk sitting on a branch not 2 feet away from you, refusing to move and blinking with its aquiline, you know, otherworldly, hawkish eyes straight into yours. And what were my problems? What were they compared with that? There's a marvelous line by Mary Oliver, one of our best contemporary women poets. And she says, tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. But meanwhile, the world goes on. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. But meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the soft pebbles of rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. The world, no matter how lonely, whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over again, announcing your place in the family of things. Over and over again, announcing your place in the family of things.
My guest is David White, and he's a poet, and in fact uses poetry in his work with corporations. He has a book called The Heart Aroused, and we'll talk about his work with corporations after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David White. He's a poet, and he's written a book called The Heart Aroused, and it's about poetry in the corporate world. Let me ask you, have you ever worked in what would be described as a corporation?
You mean as an actual paid employee?
Yes.
No, I've worked in non-profit organizations, which have the same structures, but not in your mainstream corporation. Though in the last 7 years, I've gone in to many of them as a consultant. Yes.
What got you interested in this idea of using poetry, using yourself as a poet, in the corporate world as a way to key into creativity, as a way to tap into what I think many people think is missing in the corporate world? What got you interested in that?
Well, interestingly enough, it was like the last part of the Lost poem, where the forest comes to find you and tells you where you are. Because I had gone full time as a poet and was working across the country, giving talks mostly around the path of creativity and how poetry can point out, you know, all the steps along the path that someone has experienced, almost every step along the path. And I gave a talk at a large conference in Washington, D.C., a keynote talk, and afterwards, quite a famous consultant and writer and author, Peter Block, came up to me afterwards and said, "We have to hire you," in best American fashion. And I said, "For what?" And he said, "We want you to come in the corporate world." And I was very skeptical to begin with. He said, "We're starting to tiptoe into areas for which we have no language, and it has to do with this whole area of innovation, creativity, adaptability. It's very scary territory for most of us who've grown up with our images of organizations as you know, very solid structures." And so it was a very natural invitation, and so I went in with some trepidation. And to my amazement, I found that I didn't have to compromise my work at all.
Well, let me ask you, because I'm even imagining, perhaps these are all my prejudices coming through, that you're invited for a staff retreat and introduced mm-hmm. as a poet, and I see this room full of corporate executive types with their arms folded looking at you like, "Yeah, so what does a poet have to offer me?" Do you find that resistance to
you
as a poet?
It has happened, yes. And in a way, it's a very healthy approach, because poetry has taken itself out of the mainstream. And we do need to explain ourselves. We do need to explain why the poet should come back into society. There's nothing wrong with the arms folded and having to fight your corner in a way. But the poetry speaks for itself. Most of the resistance I get is before I actually start speaking, and they just cannot understand what a poet is doing there. They also are under the impression that they will have to write poetry themselves.
A terrifying thought, right?
Yes, a source of shame for all of us when, in childhood, when Johnny's poem was always better than yours. So I disabuse them of that you're not going to have to write poetry. What we're working with here is the path of change. We're all implicated in change. Half of corporate America is scared to death these days because of the enormous changes which are occurring. And you better understand something about the phenomenology of creativity, or you won't be around. You won't be around in the company, and the company won't be around. You can also ask the questions about the usefulness of the company and what you're asking, but you ask those down the line because they're too big at the beginning. And so I start right in, and almost always people get it right away. They get it. They soon, within two or three poems, they understand the preciseness of the poetry and the way it speaks to all of our lives, and that there's room for everyone's images in there.
Let me ask you, though, because I've worked in enough different organizations and have been to enough retreats to know that this idea of change and helping people be more creative, that I've heard that so many different times.
Yes.
And yet I've worked in enough places to know that corporations resist change as if their life depended on it. Even if they say they want change, I always wonder whether, in the end, corporations really do.
Ah, right. Well, then you would have to ask that question about yourself, too. You would have to say, do human beings really want change? And the answer is both. Change always comes to us as individuals as both the most nourishing thing in our lives, and also like a knife to the throat. And why would the corporation be any different? Because it's made up of human beings like ourselves. And so the corporation is both wanting change at the moment, and it's scared to death of it, but so are each of us too, each of us. And so the measure of how much a corporation really wants to change is the measure of the people who are involved. And we must stop looking for permission from those above us in the organization before we will actually take back our lives. Many of us are actually dying in organizations little by little every day. There's a marvelous poem by William Carlos Williams. He says, "My heart rouses, thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many men and concerns many women. Look at what passes for the news. You will not find it there, but in despised poems. It is difficult to get the news from poems, but men and women die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." Men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Well, it's not only found in poetry, it's found in all the great literature. The fact that you can miss your life, you can miss it by trying to live out someone else's life. And the place where you most often try to live out someone else's life is in an organization. The pressure's there. And so it's also exactly the place where you can take back your life and say, my vision and destiny is just as important as the organization's vision and destiny. And in fact, it's at the place where those two meet where I will be a real participant in this organization and where I will have something creative to offer. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, but it also makes me want to ask you about what I think is the condition of many people's lives at work, in that work is work. Work is a way to make ends meet. There's some degree of satisfaction. There's a lot of frustration. People often feel underpaid and overworked.
Yes.
People are afraid of losing health benefits. They can't get the kind of daycare that they want. They know their children are latchkey kids. I could go on and on and on.
And on.
I think that's the condition.
The whole catastrophe.
Well, that's right. And I think that's the condition of many people's lives. And then when you bring up this idea of creativity or soul, it seems like a luxury even to contemplate what these ideas are about.
Yes. But so you could say that about any aspect of human life, that confronted with the difficulty of everyday existence, whether it's inside the corporation or bickering around the family table in the evening, that always you will be confronted with the nitty-gritty difficulties of life, but that there is nowhere else to go. Now look at how much time we spend at our workplace. We spend more time in the workplace than we do with our families. We spend more time in the workplace than we do in our churches. Our places of worship. We spend more time in the workplace than we do out in the natural world. You know, if we are not willing to examine our lives within that, the territory of work, we are in a very bad place. That means that you have chosen that you will only decide to live out your life within 20% of the time you're given. And we hope that you can make up for all you've sacrificed in the workplace outside of work or in retirement. And the time comes and you find that you've actually spent so much time building your work identity that is your whole identity and there's nothing left.
Poet and consultant David White, his book is called The Heart Aroused. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear more from David White in the second half of the show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Most of us are so busy in our jobs that we don't have time to think about anything other than what needs to get done. Poet David White thinks it's good business to think about other things too, like what's our destiny and our place in the bigger scheme of things. Coming up, we continue our conversation with David White about taking poetry and creativity into the corporate world. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a recording of a 1989 performance at the Montreal Jazz Festival, featuring bassist Charlie Hayden with trumpeter Don Cherry and drummer Edward Blackwell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Debate on the revised crime bill is opened in the Senate. Majority Leader George Mitchell is hoping controversy over the plan will be minimal. He says it wouldn't be wise for anyone to try to block the legislation. The House worked virtually around the clock over the weekend before enough votes were gathered to pass it. Senate Democrats have to get the same kind of support from the GOP that House Democrats got. But some Senate Republicans say the bill costs too much and is too soft on criminals. The third phase of a federal trial against Exxon Corporation is underway in Anchorage. Plaintiffs are seeking $15 billion in punitive damages in connection with the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound. Paula Dobbin of member station KTOO reports from Juneau.
Lawyers for Exxon are expected to argue that the oil company has been punished enough for the 1989 oil spill. So far, Exxon has spent $2 billion in cleanup costs. And earlier this month, it paid $287 million in compensatory damages to Alaska fishermen whose harvests were killed or tainted by Exxon crude. In this third phase of the trial, fishermen, Alaska natives, cities, and property owners are suing for $15 billion in punitive damages. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say it's not only to compensate for pollution damage, but to deter other oil companies from allowing a similar spill to occur in the future. Both sides are expected to present conflicting testimony from scientists over the long-term effects of the spill. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Dobbin in Juneau.
The Justice Department announced today that the largest savings and loan in the Washington, D.C. area has agreed to invest $11 million in black neighborhoods to settle charges of mortgage discrimination. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The practice is known as redlining, not offering loans in minority neighborhoods. In 1993, the Washington Post published a series of articles documenting how Chevy Chase Federal Savings Bank and its subsidiary underwrote 97% of their loans over a 16-year period in mostly white neighborhoods. The Justice Department charged the bank with discrimination. The bank denied wrongdoing, but did agree to open four offices in primarily black areas, recruit black loan officers, and offer at least $7 million worth of special home mortgage loans to minority neighborhoods. Attorney General Janet Reno said, quote, to shun an entire community because of its racial makeup is just as wrong as to reject an applicant because they are African American. This settlement must be approved in U.S. District Court. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
Queen Elizabeth and her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, are wrapping up their 10-day tour of Canada. Their trip has been marred by reports of bomb and death threats. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police says the threats were made against the Queen when she visited the Northwest Territories. On Wall Street, stock prices were lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost about 4 points to end the day at 3,751. This is NPR. The United Nations has resumed relief flights to Sarajevo. The airlift to the Bosnian capital was suspended almost a month ago when small arms fire hit relief planes. Authorities tried to resume the airlift last Thursday, but a mortar shell hit the airport. A spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says the food situation in Sarajevo is getting worse every day. Bosnian Serbs have aggravated the situation by blocking land routes to the city. Russia and Germany have agreed to work together to fight the smuggling of nuclear materials. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
According to Reuters news agency, German and Russian officials have agreed to improve communication between their intelligence agencies on nuclear smuggling. In a statement signed in Moscow, German and Russian officials agreed to tighten border controls and set up contact offices in each other's country. The statement came after 3 days of talks between Russia's chief of intelligence and the Bonn intelligence coordinator for Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Disagreement remained over the source of two-thirds of a pound of plutonium German officials confiscated earlier this month in Munich. Russian officials still deny German charges. The plutonium came from a Russian research institute or military base. In a newspaper interview this past weekend, the German finance minister said future financial aid from Bonn to Moscow will be linked to Russia's willingness to cooperate on stopping nuclear smuggling. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
The Iraqi news agency says a car bomb went off in Baghdad today, killing one child and wounding 13 people. The news agency, which is monitored by the BBC, says the booby-trapped car blew up near the offices of Iraq's government-run newspaper. Zaire has closed its border with Rwanda again, but officials say the second closing is just temporary. Zaire had sealed the border on Saturday. Authorities were worried incoming refugees could start another round of deadly epidemics in refugee camps. Thousands of angry Rwandans stormed a bridge leading to Bukavu, Zaire, yesterday and clashed with soldiers there. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're continuing our interview with poet, naturalist, and consultant David White. His new book is The Heart Aroused, Poetry and the Preservation of the Soul in Corporate America. I asked him what he means by soul.
Soul has always evaded description. That's why it's still alive as a word. Mm-hmm. But it's measured by, you know, vitality, but it's also measured by depth of feeling. It's measured by depth of thought. But most of all, I think it's measured by the experience of participation. That the soulfulness of any experience would be the amount that you felt like you were participating. And so in the workplace, it would be the amount that you felt a part and that you were wanted and needed and that you were actually contributing to something much greater. I mean, that's where the word corporation comes from. It's literally a corpus, a body. You choose the corporation to do work with others that it would be impossible to do alone. Just as we, in order to have this interview, need a building, we need engineers, we need the technical people who can build these microphones. And so, you know, the marvelous side of the corporation, the larger body of people working together, is that we can have this conversation and millions of people can listen to it all at once. The shadow sides of the corporation have to do with the way we forget what the work is about in the first place.
Let me ask you, though, and what we have been talking about is complex and not practical at all. And let me ask you, when you come
now, why would you say it's not practical?
Well, it's like, and I'm not saying that as a criticism either, because I know that you didn't write your book as 10 methods to make a more creative workforce, and I'm not even.
What if I took it as a criticism?
I don't know. I don't want you to.
But no, because the poetry is eminently practical. It tells you, okay, you and your organization are lost right now. You don't know where you... Now, most people, you see, would try to short-circuit that experience. They would say, we shouldn't be lost. We're paid to have the answer. Well, if you look at the tradition, the poetic tradition, it says there is no way you will get to any meaningful answer without being lost in the first place. And so give yourself over to the kind of questions that you are only gifted with when you're lost. Now, to me, that is an incredibly practical notion to pass to executives who otherwise might be doing something which would just take them off the nearest cliff. But as long as they were happy they were doing it, they would happily go off that cliff because they would be seen to be doing something.
You mentioned the fact that when you stand up in front of a group of corporate people or corporate executives, that as a poet you have to be practical. Can you say to them that creativity has something to do with productivity? That a more creative workforce is a truly more productive one?
I would say it is. You know, then you're getting into the whole question of what are you producing? But the link between creativity and productivity, what are you producing? How do you measure your productivity? In some ways, that's measured by the actual creativity of the workplace itself. You may decide to make fewer of something else rather than more of another thing. And yet the workplace is a kind of more profitable, happier, perhaps even a smaller place. You know, perhaps there's a smaller number of people there. When you start to ask about participation, growing larger isn't always, you know, the be-all and end-all that it would have been when your goals are have to do with something that's you know, that's more abstract, like profit, you know, profit margins. You always have to have profit. It's like breathing, but we don't ask ourselves if we're going to breathe tomorrow. We just assume we are, And so you work with profit as if it's the in-breath and out-breath of the organization. And if it's not there, the organization's going to die. So you figure that one out, so there's some kind of natural profit built in. But you certainly don't need the kind of obsessive energy around it that there has been.
Would you say, and we've been talking about the corporate world, but I'm thinking of people listening to us that may work in factories and may
yes.
have what we would call blue-collar jobs,
yes.
punching
yes.
in and punching out.
Yeah.
Does this same discussion apply to them? And do you think that...
I think I know where you're heading. I think there's a potential tragedy in this country in that there's a almost like a class separation occurring between the middle class managerial population and the blue collar population, and that we're not only being big trouble in our workplaces, but we'll be in big trouble in the society if we do not work to heal this split. But if you look at the more radical thought that's coming out of organizational development, it's saying that the line workers are the people you will educate into the business, and that eventually, you know, the people who are actually making the product, they will be the ones who will decide what managerial services they want. In other words, the managers are almost like a tax on the people who are actually doing the work. Now, that is very radical thought, but it's actually something that people are beginning to say and breathe. And you can imagine how frightening that would be to managers who see a company as a kind of divinely ordained career path. It's quite frightening indeed, but that's the direction I think we need to move in. Otherwise, we're going to have a kind of a population of semi-slave labor, and then this other population which gets to revel in creativity and all the rest. The best companies are trying to blur the distinctions between the people who are working on the line and the managers who actually watch the work, and that you try to eliminate people who are actually watching and have people pay people to actually participate and do the work itself.
We'll hear more from David White after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet and corporate consultant David White. His book is entitled The Heart Aroused. You've been talking about creativity. Creativity, of course, is about taking a risk. And risk, of course, is about the possibility of failure. Do you think failure is important at the workplace?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, we have such an enormous amount of energy around success and around always growing. That the whole side of the human experience, which has to do with fading away and dying, is just neglected. And this is, and if you look at the poetic tradition or any artistic tradition or the great contemplative and religious traditions, they all say you must embrace this side just as much as you embrace the successful, growing side of yourself. I have a poem called Faith, which has to do with embracing this side of ourselves. And it's very short. Let me give it to you. It's I wrote it when I had very little faith. First line is, I want to write about faith. I want to write about faith. About the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night. About the way the moon... I want to write about faith. About the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night. Faithful, even in its fading from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I do not give it the smallest entry. Let this, then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. Now, I talked earlier about overhearing yourself say things which you did not know you knew or didn't want to hear. What I overheard myself saying in that poem was that phrase about the moon, faithful even in its fading from fullness. I said to myself after I wrote that poem, what would it be like if I had equal faith in the part of me that was dying and fading away at any one time as the part of me that was growing what life would, you know, that was a radical thought to me.
Hmm.
And when you think about it, you know, if someone comes to our, came to our door and said, how about going downtown tonight and hearing some jazz? And you said, sorry, you should have come a couple of weeks ago, but the moon is fading away right now, and I don't go out of the house at night when the moon is growing smaller. I only go out when the moon is growing larger. And I certainly do not go out when there's, for those 3 nights of the month when there's no moon at all. Now, if someone said this to us, we would think them slightly insane, if not fully insane. And yet this is exactly what we do with our own psyches. We say, unless I'm actually growing and succeeding and becoming larger all the time, then I actually don't exist. That when I'm dying or fading away, which is half of any human experience at any given time, then I actually don't exist. And that I, it's just a time I have to get through until I get through to this waxing part of the cycle again. And if you look at all the great artistic traditions, all the great geniuses, you know, all the musicians and the painters and the poets and the writers, they've always been able to embrace this dark, fading side of human existence, that you would have equal faith in that part as you would. And this has very practical ramifications in the workplace. You know, for instance, for the Boeing company to change from making propeller-driven aeroplanes to jet aeroplanes in the late 1940s, early 1950s, took incredible amount of change in the company. It had to go through a whole dying. All its production lines were set up to make propeller-driven aeroplanes. No one else was making commercial jet planes. They had to die to themselves, literally, and set up a whole new life centered around this untried technology. And so there you had this ability to give yourself over to the fading side. And unless you could do that, you would never move at all. You would always stay with what seemed to be giving you full light at any one time.
So what would you like work to be? I mean, if almost imagining a work day and people not leaving their soul at the front door and picking it up when they go home.
Yes.
But what would you like a creative, soulful workplace to look like?
I would like it to be a place where you could ask questions about your own personal destiny within that context. And you could choose what you wanted to make or do as part of that, but that you would be able to say, how am I living out my destiny within this corporation, within this body, within this group of people? And if you couldn't ask that question, you would go somewhere else where you could ask it. And I think that life is too precious and there's too much at stake. Your own life is at stake. Poetic tradition says you could lose everything. You could live out someone else's life thinking it's your own. And that is the ultimate tragedy. And that just because we happen to be earning a living at the time, you have no excuse to give away your life to someone else. It's too precious. And there's only one life you have, and only you can live it out. And therefore, you would ask that question in the workplace.
What do you say, though, to someone who says, look, I'm stuck in this job. My kids need to go to the school in the area. My husband can't change his job. I don't like what I do. I don't have the kind of authority, power to change anything. I'm just kind of stuck. I mean, what do you say to them?
There are no easy answers to this, and there should be no answer that you can give to that person because only they can really provide it. But the poetic tradition, as far as I can see, says that the only way you will get yourself out of that living death scenario, which is what your description is that you would actually cultivate your desires and your longings, and they would lead you out into the world. And so you would forget the logistics of the fact that my husband wants to stay in this town and in this job, and you would forget the logistics of all the money you have to pay for the private schools, or you would forget the logistics of the car payments, and you would simply work on what is most precious to you, and that in itself sets up a kind of momentum in the human psyche in which logistical questions take a back seat. They align themselves almost within the force field of the questions you're asking. In other words, the desire itself does the work. And this is not a selfish desire. This is a desire that's trying to lead you into more participation in the world. It's important to make that distinction.
So you're saying
it's the feeling that your life is at stake, and unless you felt this, you would only have lived half your life.
So you're saying make the most important thing, make the thing you love the most in your life the most important thing.
Yes, that's right.
And even if you can't, say you want to climb the Himalayas, I mean, even if you'll never be able to do that, you think it's enough just to imagine it and read about it and look at pictures and...
You would hold it in all the ways, and perhaps that would it might lead to a trip to the Himalayas and some kind of fulfillment. Or you may get to the Himalayas and you get there, as I did, in fact, in the Himalayas, and find that the top of the mountain leads back into the world, that you suddenly see your whole life down that mountain valley and down that pass, and that you can actually get a kind of... just an incredible vision of the life that might lie ahead of you, not in the sense of details, but in the sense of qualities you can feel. I had that experience in the Himalayas. I had this terrible yearning to go there. I'd been there two or three times. I went there, and I found the Himalayas led me back into airport hotel rooms, you know, in Akron Airport, working with people in the corporate world. And there's another kind of Himalaya there, too.
David White is a poet and consultant and author of The Heart Aroused, Poetry and the Preservation of the Soul in Corporate America. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, the Mexican elections were held over the weekend. The ruling party appears to have won. We'll have a conversation on what happens now. The NAACP has chosen an acting director. We hope to talk to him. Elizabeth Arnold will report on the crime bill that passed over the weekend and what happens to that when it goes to the Senate. Our population piece this week will be on Norplant. We'll have a report on the deaths at the Glenwood Fire in Colorado from Howard Berkus. And Noah Adams will be looking at the elephant rampage in Hawaii and the greatest jukebox in the United States. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
In 1989, bassist Charlie Hayden was the guest of honor at the Montreal Jazz Festival. He played 8 concerts in 8 days, each with a different group. One night, he held a reunion with 2 players he'd known since early in his career in the 1950s, trumpeter Don Cherry and drummer Edward Blackwell. A recording of that concert has now been released. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Charlie Hayden, Don Cherry, and Edward Blackwell first recorded together in 1960 as part of Ornette Coleman's quartet. Hayden's CD, The Montreal Tapes, documents one of the trio's periodic reunions held in 1989. The program consists mostly of classic Ornette tunes, but these performances sound so fresh, it's almost as if that 3-decade gap didn't exist. The hardest of hard times have befallen these musicians in the 5 years since this recording. Drummer Edward Blackwell died of kidney disease 2 years ago. Bassist Charlie Hayden has been suffering from a severe case of tinnitus, which makes loud sounds painful to his ears. When he plays live nowadays, he and the other players on stage are isolated from each other by large acoustic panels. Sometimes they can't hear each other too well. Don Cherry's trumpet chops have deteriorated to where listening to him can be painful to your ears. Although Hayden is the nominal leader on this CD, Don Cherry is the star. He makes most of the announcements, wrote the only two non-Ornette Coleman tunes, and he sounds uncommonly strong and lyrical. It's not that Cherry doesn't flub any notes. He always does that. But his mobility and distinctive muted tone are a treat. He's the reason to pick this album up. Here's Don Cherry on Ornette Coleman's Law Years. Now that the generation of innovators who came along in the 1950s is aging and even dying off, it's absurd that their music is still referred to by friend and foe as quote-unquote avant-garde. In reality, this brand of jazz is a long-established style, just like bebop or cool jazz, styles not much older than the music of Ornette Coleman and his disciples. Some folks call it freebop, but whatever you call it, it should be plain to anyone with ears that this music calls for the same virtuosity and conceptual daring that characterizes most great art. The freebop style is a classic, and that'd be true whether this music was recorded in 1959, or 1989, or 1999.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, CD Review, Pulse, and The Village Voice. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shorrock directs the show, and we welcome station WETA-FM in Washington, D.C., which begins broadcasting the show today. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. David Hilfiker. His patients are homeless men in Washington, D.C. Dr. Hilfiker practices what he describes as poverty medicine. He says it's closer to the medicine practiced in the Third World than to what is ordinarily considered modern medicine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.